Welcome. Thank you for coming. I'm really just honored to have this panel with me today. All of the three people here today have done really, really important work in bringing this crazy issue to light. And I'm so grateful for all of them for making their way here today and for all of you to come to hear us. Detlef Knape Knape, I hope I'm saying that correctly, is a water scientist. He is to my right. He is the co-author of the study that identified Gen X and other PFAS chemicals in drinking water that came from the Cape Fear River in North Carolina. And he very much helped bring that situation to light. Detlef is a bit of a local celebrity in North Carolina, if you can be a local celebrity and a water engineer at the same time. And that is because he has been incredibly generous with his technical knowledge, with his scientific understanding, sharing it, explaining it, talking to people. He has taken my calls at weird hours, called me back at weird hours, repeated things, gone over things that I didn't understand time and time again, and I'm very grateful. Judith Enck, on the left, has done a lot of work on PFAS, particularly in the Hoosick Falls area in upstate New York. Judith was Region 2 director in the EPA during the Obama years, 2009 to 2016. And she continues to do a lot of work in Hoosick Falls and elsewhere on PFAS. She's also working on climate change and other issues and has been incredibly useful, not just with reporters on the issue of PFAS, but also on the inner workings of the EPA and other environmental issues, and I encourage you to seek her out. On my left, directly, is Robert Bellot, or Rob Bellot. And Rob has done more than anyone I know to bring this issue of PFAS contamination to light. Rob Bellot headed the litigation in West Virginia and Ohio against DuPont that began with a farmer named Wilbur Tennant, whose property abutted land where DuPont was dumping these chemicals. And the farmer's cattle, all of them, hundreds of them, got sick and died. Rob Bellot represented them. He told that story, and that litigation turned into class action litigation on behalf of people in the area whose water was contaminated. And it was because of that litigation that we got thousands and thousands of documents that explained exactly what DuPont knew about those chemicals, what those chemicals did, what their internal research showed they did to lab animals, to workers that they were accumulating, that they were causing health effects, that they had leaked out into the community. And it was all that information that ultimately got the plaintiffs he was representing. I think there's been, more than $1 billion in payouts from DuPont in that litigation since then. And in addition, that litigation brought out together a panel of scientists who were able to draw links between exposure to these chemicals and health outcomes, six different diseases, and he was able to use that in court to hold the company liable. So, of course, another upshot of this amazing litigation is that we have all these documents that has made it possible for reporters to explore the corporate responsibility, not just of DuPont, but of other companies as well, and to understand what it means that we have these chemicals that persist in the environment indefinitely, that persist in human bodies. And it's been a really important educational tool, those documents. And Rob, too, has been incredibly generous with his knowledge and insight, and he has not stopped with his legal work. He's gone on to do things like be here today to explain the significance of all this. So this is a really complicated area, and I stumbled on it myself in 2015 when I was doing a story which I thought was about the Christie administration in New Jersey, because it was about a water quality body, a little administrative body that was in the process of setting a safety level for PFOA, and in the midst was shut down. And I was trying to see if there was a connection between, you know, what it was doing and having its work stopped. In the process, I found out that there was also litigation around the same chemical in West Virginia. That is how I connected with Rob Ballot and ended up writing quite a bit about these chemicals. In the 3-plus years since I began writing about these chemicals, so much has happened. It's been insane. I feel like I've written about a lot of crazy things over the years, and this one very much takes the cake. I'm just going to quickly tick off some of the things, some of the sort of major things, developments that have happened in the 3 years I've been looking at this, and then we're going to, each of our speakers is going to take a few minutes, give a little presentation. I'm going to ask some questions, and then you all, I hope, will ask questions too. Okay, so since my first story, which was really about PFOA in West Virginia in 2015, we've realized that PFOA is not the single problem, nor is PFOA and PFOS, another chemical that we've heard about. But there are actually thousands of chemicals in this class. I think the latest from the OECD is 4,300, but I've actually heard higher estimates too. So there are thousands of chemicals in this class. And contamination is not just by a few industrial facilities, which is where we first learned about it, but actually around the country. Many of the hot spots are near military bases where firefighting foam was used. And we know that one estimate from the EWG puts the number of people affected in terms of drinking water that's contaminated at some level at more than 100 million. So the level, which I mentioned, you know, I said at some level, there's a lot of dispute right now about what level is safe. The EPA has set 70 parts per trillion as a drinking level. Many other places and institutions have come up with lower safety thresholds, New Jersey in particular, but also EFSA in Europe, and we have other states and also scientists who are saying the number should be much lower, about sevenfold and lower. Okay, and so we have some health research on PFOA and PFOS. We have less on the other chemicals, but we do know that just as they serve the same industrial function, some of them, in many cases, they can be expected to have some similar health effects. We do have studies, for instance, from Gen X, one of the replacement chemicals, which DuPont introduced to replace PFOA, and we know from their own studies that they had similar effects on lab animals, including tumors. Okay, so just to look ahead a little bit at some of the many areas I think that we'll all be covering in the coming years, or at least the coming year, is one is we're obviously in the middle of a major process of investigating how much contamination we have, particularly around military sites. And so I think we need to be asking about the scope of that investigation and the scope of the cleanup that will be done. How many chemicals are people looking for? At what levels are they going to be cleaned up? And a huge issue I think that I think we're all going to be grappling with is who will pay. I know I've run into a lot of folks in communities where already, you know, they have filters that need to be replaced, and who pays for this, right? And so these are questions that are going to come up. When will we be phasing the use of these chemicals out, which, of course, has not happened yet? So entirely. The military is in the process, maybe, of phasing out PFOA and PFOS in firefighting foam, but actually, in many cases, seems to be phasing in foam that contains replacement chemicals, even though there is other foam available. And then there's a whole world of regulation. We'll get into that more, and what government agencies should be doing. And there is so much going on nationally, but just to also bring our attention to the fact that this is actually a global issue. Contamination is global, and there are hot spots around the world, as there are around the country. Australia is very much dealing with this problem. Italy, Sweden, we have U.S. bases, military bases in Japan and elsewhere that have big problems. Okay, before I introduce everyone, I also want to say to, just want to like give a bow to all of you local reporters who have been handling this right here in Michigan. Garrett over there doing an awesome job. In North Carolina, in Vermont, in Hoosick Falls, in Bucks County, in Minnesota, North Carolina, Cape Cod, Washington State, it's insane. But I've been really awed by all the amazing coverage. Okay, so, all right, so I'm going to hand it off for now, Judith to start, and if you would, please.
Great. Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm Judith Enk. I'm a recovering environmental regulator. I've spent 17 years in senior positions in New York State government and, as mentioned, served as regional administrator at EPA Region 2 during the Obama administration. Here's the bad news. No one in government has a handle on this issue. And if they say they do, they're not being truthful. This is a really important public health issue that regulatory agencies are really behind on. I want to talk to you a little bit about my experience as a regulator in upstate New York, and I'm going to tell the story mostly with like little sidebars on things you may want to consider as you cover this issue. And I want to start by saying this issue would not have really emerged as a major issue if not for Brendan Lyons, a reporter with the Albany Times Union, and Scott Waldman, who at the time was at Politico, who's now at E&E. And you should Google both of their articles, and also great information on the Bennington College website. I'm now a visiting professor at Bennington College, teaching on plastics pollution. But this is all kind of connected. So I'm sitting at my desk one day. My desk is like a Superfund site. And I get a call, but I know where everything is. I get a call from the Rensselaer County executive asking me if I had $3 million to give to the community of Hoosick Falls, New York, to install carbon filtration. I said, gee, no, my discretionary budget at EPA is $5,000, which I hardly ever used, a couple books one year. But I said, tell me what's going on in Hoosick Falls. And it happened to be the home county where I lived for 30 years. It was 45 minutes from my home. And she told me that their public water supply serving 3,500 people has high levels of PFOA. And the company, St. Gobain, and their predecessor company, Honeywell, has sent all the elected officials out to look for government money to install the carbon filtration. And the first thing I said was, gee, they are legally liable to cover those costs. You don't have to get federal or state dollars for that. And fast forward, that site in Hoosick Falls is now a state Superfund site and a federal Superfund site. So I told the county executive, who was well-meaning, I'll get back to her if I can find any money. I quickly call the New York State Health Department, and something you all should understand is when EPA was established by Richard Nixon, the good old days of bipartisan cooperation on the environment, the way Nixon set up the EPA is a lot of the programs are delegated to states. So EPA does the regulation, does a lot of science, but the theory, and it's not a bad one, is that state governments are closer to communities. So for the Safe Drinking Water Act in 49 states, the states are in the lead. What's the one state where it's not? Wyoming. So I quickly called the top guy at the New York State Health Department and said, what's going on in Hoosick Falls? And he told me, and I said, so how long have you known that people have been drinking contaminated water? And he said, oh, you know, a little over a year. And I said, when are you going to tell the public? And he said, well, we're meeting with the company. So at that point, and this is hard for me, at some point you just have to be quiet and listen and take a lot of notes. So you know that. I don't know that. So he explained to me that the state health department, the county health department, the mayor, the previous mayor of Hoosick Falls, St. Gobain, the polluter, have been meeting for about 16 months to figure out what to do. And the way that we learned that there were high levels of PFOA in the public water supply was a local resident, Michael Hickey, and the local doctor, Dr. Martinez, because in upstate New York it's Martinez, not Martinez, they went to the village board and said, we're concerned because Michael lost his father to kidney cancer. We're concerned that there might be PFOA in the drinking water wells, which are just a few hundred yards from this plant. And they didn't manufacture PFOA there. They were just using it. So the town board refused to test the water, so Michael Hickey on his own sent water samples out to a lab, and that's something you all should consider doing because agencies are slow to proactively go test when it's not a regulated contaminant. And so he had a hard time finding a lab that would test for PFOA, but he found one, and it's called AXYS, A-X-Y-S, in Canada. I think it was $400 per sample. He paid out of pocket. I think they did four samples. They all came back with elevated levels. Then that got the local government to ask the state health department to test. They then started doing state testing, found similar results, elevated levels, and started to take this more seriously. But remember, let's go back to the fact that they weren't telling the public that they were drinking contaminated water. So I called everyone I knew in state government and said, you need to tell the public to stop drinking the water. They didn't, so I did, and that resulted in the state finally saying, don't drink the water, and the company providing free bottled water at the local supermarket. So when you went shopping, you could take unlimited bottled water. We did ramp up recycling for bottled water in Hoosick Falls, and then the company realized that they had to eventually pay for carbon filtration. They also, the state of New York, started testing private wells, found widespread contamination in private wells. There's a nearby town, Petersburg, who had a company called Taconic Plastics, much smaller community, 10 miles away. Their aquifers also contaminated, so the state replicated what they were doing there. The citizens were absolutely amazing. The government failed them. I don't think EPA failed them, and I'm not saying that just because I was at EPA, but we went to the community. We did a big meeting at the high school, you know, 800 people there on a frozen cold night. There were strong efforts not to have EPA be vocal on this, but we just kept going with the facts. The state health department eventually tested people's blood for PFOA. And there's a really interesting photojournalism project that the citizens did on their own. And basically they had residents come in and get their pictures taken, or they took it themselves, and they held up what their PFOA blood level was in front of them. And I can tell you, a bunch of my colleagues at EPA were so moved by this. As I wandered into people's offices, I would often see printouts of these photos. And this is it was all done on Twitter. So it's the Twitter feed is PFOA Project NY numeral 1. It's been dormant lately, but there are some of those pictures are just so compelling, especially of the students. The State Health Department then did a health survey and declared there are no adverse health impacts from PFOA, which we totally didn't believe. So you know, Bob will talk about the C8 study, which was incredibly helpful, and specific illnesses were identified if you have PFOA in your drinking water. One is testicular cancer. The State Health Department said no high levels. They found no cases of testicular cancer in Hoosick Falls, but a bunch of the citizens called me and said, that can't be true. We know of cases of testicular cancer in Hoosick Falls. So I got the harebrained idea of doing our own health questionnaire, thinking we could do it in a couple months. It took us a year. But we found results very different from the State Health Department. And we did this study with Bennington College. It went through the IRB. We had virtually very, very limited budget. We did it mostly with volunteers. So the health issues are front and center. And that is really work worth focusing on, even if you're relying on community health surveys.
And next we're going to hear, thank you, Judith, that was awesome. We're going to hear next from Detlef.
Sure. Microphone in front of his mouth. Okay.
All right, good afternoon. So I prepared a few slides also to make it a little bit visual. So I'm hoping that at this meeting, where a lot of environmental journalists are gathered, that this is also a motivational and inspiring story. And I would say the only reason that the Gen X story came to light was because an environmental journalist was successfully conveying the information to the impacted residents in Wilmington, North Carolina. So, yeah, just to highlight again the challenge with PFAS, this class of chemicals that contains, you know, maybe 5,000 chemicals or so, maybe more, is that there are many different sources through which these chemicals enter the environment. So a lot of focus has been on fluorochemical manufacturers like Chemours or DuPont, and in large part this story that I'm going to tell you is about that aspect, the fluorochemical manufacturing process itself. But as you heard, for example, from Judith, you know, once these fluorochemicals are made, they get used at other places, and in those locations, again, there are emissions to the environment, either into the air or into the water. Sometimes these chemicals end up in the sludge of wastewater treatment plants. So there's just so many different vectors how these chemicals get out in the environment. So I often show this Teflon pan, and the point of the Teflon pan is not so much that people should be concerned about PFAS exposure from using a Teflon pan, but when that Teflon pan gets made, there are emissions of fluorochemicals into the environment. But we are sometimes directly exposed to these chemicals through, for example, food contact paper. A lot of these food wrappers are water and oil repellent papers, and there are often fluorochemicals involved in making these papers grease and water and resistant. Also, if you buy your $500 Gore-Tex jacket, Gore-Tex is essentially like Teflon. It's a fluoropolymer. So in making this jacket, you also contribute to the emissions. And if you like Scotchgard, well, Scotchgard is the active ingredient, is a fluorochemical. It used to be PFOS. Later, it became PFBS. And then as Sharon already mentioned, firefighting foams are a very important aspect of fluorochemical contamination. A lot of firefighting training areas are places where PFAS enter the environment and have entered the environment for decades. And there are now alternatives, fluorine-free alternatives, but the current military specifications for firefighting foam specify that they have to contain fluorine chemistry, but that is currently being challenged in front of Congress. And the civilian airports, they basically piggyback on the mil-spec requirements, so fluorochemical foams right now are still also the standard at civilian airports, but there is movement, especially in Europe, to go away from fluorine chemistry for firefighting foams. If you want to learn more about fluorochemical compounds, I also put this website, the six classes, at the bottom here. That's a nice visual a site that explains, you know, how, as consumers, we purchase a lot of products that contain fluorochemicals, and this gives you a little bit of an idea what kinds of consumer products contain fluorochemicals. But this story is about North Carolina, so I think a lot of you know where North Carolina is, but I did put the U.S. map up there. But then within the North Carolina watersheds is the Cape Fear River Basin, and that's the largest watershed in the state of North Carolina, and it's the drinking water source of 1.5 million North Carolinians. And the reason why I wanted to show you slides is just to give you an idea of the geography here. We're studying actually three communities and then some in this river basin. And so Community A is an upstream community, and it's a small community called Pittsboro. And as you will see shortly, they're impacted by PFAS. Then Community B is Fayetteville. That's been in the news recently because of the flooding related to Hurricane Florence. And the Cape Fear River crested at record levels in Fayetteville as a result of Florence. And then just south of Fayetteville, you see there I put PFAS manufacturing plant. You know, that's a facility that actually has three companies on there, Chemours, DuPont, and Curare. But most of the fluorochemical emissions currently, we believe, are associated with the Chemours facility. And then Community C is about 90 miles downstream. That's Wilmington, North Carolina. So downstream of the fluorochemical manufacturing site, there's about 250,000 people that live downstream, and Wilmington, North Carolina, gets their drinking water from the Cape Fear River. And also some smaller communities, Brunswick County, Pender County, are impacted by that same fluorochemical discharge. So when we studied PFAS concentrations in the rivers at these three communities, because in all of three of these communities, the drinking water comes from the river. And what you see in Pittsboro in Community A is that a lot of the old PFAS compounds, we don't have to bother with all the alphabet soup right now. If you add it all up, you know, it's getting close to 400 parts per trillion. And if you just remember 70 parts per trillion as a benchmark, at least what the EPA currently considers as an acceptable level for PFOS and PFOA, the levels in this community often exceed PFOA and PFOS concentrations above the 70 nanogram per liter level. Once you go to Fayetteville in Community B, all of that dilutes out. But then once we go further downstream to Wilmington, that big red bar, you know, that's the Gen X that showed up in this water. And so the Gen X exclusively originated from the Chemours facility prior DuPont. So that's in the river, but you know, there was a paper in 2015 that was published, and it got very little attention, in part because, you know, what's in the river doesn't necessarily mean it's also in people's drinking water. But I work a lot with drinking water providers, so we got to sample the PFAS levels at different points in the water treatment plant. And for simplicity, I'm just showing you the raw and the finished water. So the raw water is what's in the river. The finished water is the tap water, basically, what people consume. And what this shows is there was no removal of these chemicals, right? And this is a state-of-the-art water treatment plant. You know, they go way above and beyond what most drinking water plants do in this country. And so that was shocking. You know, this utility designed their system knowing that they're at the mouth of the river, right? They live way downstream, right? If you're all familiar with the concept, we all live downstream, right? There's wastewater inputs upstream, and so they wanted to provide plenty of barriers that remove pollutants from the water. But the PFAS are basically not removed. The other thing that's very interesting here is in 2013 to 2015, EPA looked at PFAS occurrence across the entire country. That was called the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule. So UCMR3, that's what I'm showing here. The light green bar, that neon green bar, was the only fluorochemical that showed up in that water. All the other ones were missed, right? So while the UCMR3 data set is great, it has a lot of limitations. And, you know, the red bar here is Gen X. Gen X is still the red bar on this graph, but it's way on the left. There were all these other fluorochemicals in the water that my colleague Mark Streiner discovered through high-resolution mass spectrometry, and we didn't even have standards, analytical standards for them, so we couldn't tell people what's the concentration of the PFAS in the water. But clearly, the levels were much, much higher than the levels of Gen X. You know, so the total PFAS concentration in this water was on the order of maybe 40,000 parts per trillion. And, you know, so we did what people in universities do. We wrote a paper. And so we got this paper published in one of the most prestigious journals in my field, so we felt good about that. But what really ached all of us was, well, how can we change the situation, right? We felt this is bad, but how can we get people to pay attention to this? And, you know, so my colleagues from EPA, they informed Region 4, which is the region that's responsible for North Carolina. Nothing happened. I sent this paper twice to our Department of Environmental Quality, and I got one response back from their analytical chemist. That's interesting. But all the people who are dealing with regulations and enforcement basically said nothing. And so I tried all sorts of stuff, and I was getting very frustrated with this. Even I thought, you know, entities that would be very interested in this basically said we can't do anything about that. So I was basically on the verge of giving up. You know, this was stretching into March and April of 2017. And then out of the blue, I get this email from a reporter. And initially, I was pretty dubious about, you know, this request. I looked this guy up, and I was like, has this guy written about, you know, environmental issues before? And I couldn't really find anything. And so I decided, well, I won't talk to this guy. So, but then, you know, a week later or so, I get another email, and I was like, well, you know, maybe I should, you know. Maybe there's something here. And so I said, I contact him. I agreed to a phone call with him, and I said, what's your deadline? And he said, I don't have a deadline. I was like, oh, this is good. So, you know, because often I get these phone calls, it's like, I have a deadline in 30 minutes, and it's like, I'm not talking with you. So this turned out to be an awesome interaction. So this guy, I'll show you the name in a second, you know, was doing an excellent job investigating this issue, and he came up with documents that I would have never found, you know, documents from the Netherlands, documents that were, you know, pretty deep down in the belly of our state DEQ website. And so we both learned a lot together, and, you know, it was very productive in terms of collaboration. And so this ended up in the newspaper on June 7th, and it was amazing. It was this article basically brought the issue to light to the entire community, to local officials, and for a moment, everybody was on the same page. You know, it didn't matter what politics you belonged to; everybody was upset about this, and the net result was that very quickly a meeting got organized with Chemours. Chemours, for some reason, disclosed that they had been discharging Gen X into the river since 1980, which is a separate story altogether. You know, we thought it only was being produced since 2009. And the net result was that very quickly the wastewater got captured. So this was not through regulation, but, you know, an agreement between DEQ, our Department of Environmental Quality, and Chemours, and the levels of PFAS dropped very quickly in people's drinking water. So the moral of the story is, you know, that as journalists, you can make a big difference if it's done well and if it reaches the right audience. And I'll stop here for now.
Thank you, Deva. Rob, you want to take it from there?
Yeah, thank you. First of all, I wanted to thank all of you for letting me be here. It's a real honor to be here, because I see this issue we're talking about today as a national public health threat. And I believe that the folks here in this room, many of you have already written about this, are doing a tremendous public service to get information out. And that's why I'm here. This is something I've been working on for many years, trying to make sure as much information gets out to as many people as possible. You know, I come at it from a slightly different angle, since I'm a lawyer, and I've been representing the people who've been drinking this stuff or been exposed to it. And the people that are coming to me saying, what do we do about this? We're being told there are no state or federal regulations, that the agencies can't do anything. The companies are saying they're not required to do anything. What can we do as the community, as the actual people drinking this stuff, what can we do? And so this has now gone on for me for about 20 years, trying to explore all the different ways to try to get this stuff out of people's water, get people educated about what these chemicals are, how broad of a group of materials we're talking about here, and what the real public health threat is. And I think the folks in this room, you know, have been doing a great job getting that information out. And, you know, I thought it might be helpful to kind of give just a little bit of a history of how we got to where we're at today, and at least some of the things that I think have been sort of critical events, particularly as the story has unfolded. You know, it started in 1998, at least my perception of it, with a farmer in West Virginia whose cows were getting sick after drinking white foaming water coming out of a landfill, and came to us and most of what I had been doing up to that point was representing big chemical companies. This gentleman came to me. It was friends with my mom's family. So he came in, and we looked at his photographs, videotapes, and saw, okay, well, this is obviously something's in this white foaming water. We should be able to handle this. This is what we do. You know, it was through that case we started litigation against the DuPont Company. They were the owner of that landfill, and they had the world's largest Teflon manufacturing facility right down the road along the Ohio River. This landfill was accepting waste from that facility. What we found out through that litigation was that there was this chemical that was being used to make Teflon. It was a surfactant, something used in the manufacturing process called PFOA. And large quantities of it were being used, emitted up the stacks from the factory into the air, directly into the Ohio River, and 7,000 tons of it had been dumped into this landfill, and it creates foam, and that's what these cows had been drinking. Well, you know, it was through litigation and discovery in the litigation process, we got access to all of these internal documents, as Sharon mentioned. And what we saw was this was a chemical that we're wondering, how is this something that is not regulated at this point in time? If they're using so much of it, my world had been focused on regulated listed materials. Well, here's something I had never seen before. What we saw was this was something that dated back to the 1950s. It had been invented by the 3M company in Minnesota right after World War II. This is prior to there being an EPA. Decades before, there were EPA rules and regulations. So these were existing chemicals that were already out there before some of the very first federal laws came into play in the 70s, 1976 in particular, with the Toxic Substances Control Act. These chemicals were already out there. So we were dealing with something where we're dealing with existing chemicals where the people using them were being told, you have an obligation to tell EPA if you think there's some substantial risk from this chemical. But other than that, EPA isn't necessarily going to see any of this information. Well, what we were seeing was there were decades and decades of studies that had been done by 3M, the manufacturer, DuPont as a big customer of not only PFOA, but a related chemical, and related chemicals, PFOS, that was used in Scotchgard by 3M. And there was all kinds of very troubling toxicity data. There were epidemiology studies. And most of this wasn't published. It wasn't peer-reviewed. It wasn't out there in the literature for folks to find. But it was in these internal documents. I'm looking at all this data in the year 2000, early 2001. And what really struck me was when we found that there were no state or federal regulations because the agencies probably didn't even know this chemical existed, but the company itself had set its own drinking water guideline. You know, DuPont had one of the most sophisticated group of scientists in the world, the Haskell Laboratory, thousands of scientists. They'd been studying this. They knew about the unique persistence and bioaccumulative aspect of this chemical, completely man-made, non-naturally occurring material. Once it gets out there in the environment, it stays forever, all right? It can get in people, and when it gets in people, it stays in their blood, and every little exposure builds up and up and up. So DuPont and 3M saw this information by as early as 1976, 1977, all right, that this was uniquely persistent and bioaccumulative. And their scientists start looking at this, and they went out and sampled the water around the plant because they knew it was going up into the air, into the drinking water around the DuPont plant. Their own scientists set a drinking water standard, a guideline, one part per billion, which just happened to be the analytical detection level for PFOA at the time. The analytical detection level was 0.6 parts per billion. The actual drinking water guideline DuPont came up with, 0.6, rounded up to one part per billion. So you have DuPont's own scientists looking at this data in the 1980s saying, basically, if it's detectable, you need to filter it out. So I'm looking through all this, and what I see repeatedly is the public isn't necessarily being told any of this. The people drinking it aren't necessarily being told. DuPont goes out and samples public water supplies around the factory. By 1984, they know it's in the public water. They know it's above their own one part per billion guideline by 1988 when they set that limit. And we also see is by 1988, they'd done cancer studies and internally classified it as a confirmed animal carcinogen, possible human carcinogen, by 1988. Yet still the public drinking it isn't being told. So I'm seeing all this data, realizing that we may be the only ones who've seen this data. So I put together a letter in 2001. Sent it out to US EPA, the state agencies, saying essentially, this stuff's in the water. Let's do something about this. Okay? Now, the community finally finds out that it's in the water. They come to us and say, well, what can we do? There's no state or federal guidelines. We brought a lawsuit against DuPont in 2001, class action seeking medical monitoring. I don't get into all the legal details of that claim and what that means, but we are essentially trying to get it out of the water and get the appropriate testing done to see what it could do to people over the long term. As we were in that case, I was trying to get as much of this information out to the public agencies. And one way to do that, when you put things in the court file, okay, they become public document, in the public docket. US EPA at one point established a public docket. In 2003, they announced they were going to start investigating this chemical, PFOA. Right? 3M in 2000 had already said, we're pulling it off the market. Okay? But in 2003, we started pushing the issue of PFOA. They create a public docket for PFOA information. Information from the court files and from the court case, all these internal documents start getting sent into the EPA public docket. They're in public court files. And the media is able to access that information. At this point, this had been fairly a localized West Virginia issue that was being covered, if at all, by the Parkersburg paper. It finally filters out to Ken Ward, the Charleston Gazette, who starts doing some excellent articles about it. So it's now made it statewide. And I think it was in 2003. Mike Hawthorne, am I here? All right. Hi. It was at the Columbus Dispatch at the time, did an expose of these internal documents, finally starting to shed light on this. And it's finally, the story is finally starting to move outside of the local West Virginia community. That's the point when EPA starts its investigation. The Environmental Working Group is able to access these documents through the public files, through the public dockets. They start focusing on this issue of pollution in people, all right, in 2003. ABC's 2020 does a show about it in late 2003. Our class action then settles in 2004. EPA actually sues DuPont. In 2004, after looking through all this information, they realize there is internal documents, internal information about substantial risk to human health that should have been turned over to these agencies decades ago. If you had given it to us earlier, we could have begun looking at this decades ago. That was 2004. So there's a lot of coverage that starts, media coverage in 2004. There's a panic in China. They're pulling pans off the shelves. It's at that point DuPont agreed to settle the case in West Virginia and agreed to settle the case with EPA. Under that settlement, you heard about it, we set up a science panel that was going to look at all of the data, not just what was published, not what the companies chose to publish, but all of it, and study that community and independently confirm what can drinking this do to you, okay? What health effects? That started in 2005. We ended up getting 69,000 people to participate in that study. We knew we had to have a big enough sample pool to address the issue Judith just mentioned, which is when you're doing community studies, you have to have a big enough sample to find valid results. Otherwise, what we've been seeing over and over, yeah, we're seeing these bad health effects, but we don't have enough. That's not statistically significant and all of that argument. So we had to have a big enough study. That process started in 2005. You then had the phase-out announced. DuPont and about eight other companies decide they're going to phase out the manufacture of PFOA. From that point on, from 2006 to about 2012, the issue sort of went away, okay? Because it was perceived as if we're not making it anymore, so this problem's gone away, all right? Then what you have happening is the scientific panel came out at the end of 2012 confirming six links to disease, including two types of cancer, to drinking PFOA. I gave that to US EPA and said, what more do we need now to move forward on a drinking water guideline? All right. That's when we start finally going out and sampling through the UCMR program to take samples of the drinking water supplies across this country, 2013, 2014. Sure enough, These things are being found in the water all over the country. Because as you've heard, it's used, you know, this stuff is used pervasively everywhere. By this point, it's in the blood of virtually every human on the planet. Okay, this is not a local West Virginia issue. This is a nationwide issue global issue at this point. So when these water supply results start coming in, 2013, 2014, we finally, through our science panel, has established these links. The people that had one of these diseases in West Virginia and Ohio, they were able to move forward with claims against DuPont, saying these things have actually caused my injury. The first one of those went to trial in late 2015. There was a verdict against DuPont. It was the first time they were held liable for causing somebody's cancer or any kind of personal injury. That, in conjunction with the Flint, what was going on here in Flint, Michigan, with drinking water, Mr. Hickey had gone online and had seen the science panel results about the cancer links and said maybe this is related to PFOA, and that he goes out and samples his own water. All right, all of this starts converging in late 2015 or 2016. And it's been remarkable to me to see the pickup in some great investigative journal. Sharon has done an amazing job. There's about an 18-part now series on these chemicals that started really in late 2015. New York Times did articles, Huffington Post. All of this finally starts coming out. And what we're seeing now is you see this reference, and I'll wrap up, I'm sorry. You see this reference now to these as being emerging contaminants, and that's my pet peeve, all right? These are not, they've emerged, okay? They emerged 60 years ago. The only thing that's emerging now is the public awareness of this. And when this is, particularly you see this happen is when it gets found in a local community's water supply, it's as if this is, here's this new chemical that we're suddenly finding out about. This is the same stuff, okay? It's just being found in more places because people are finally testing. The state of Michigan is one of the few that's out there right now actively testing all their public water supplies, and which is generating all this data. If other states start doing, I would guarantee you're going to find this as well. This is not just this one chemical. It's not just this one community. This is a whole class of chemicals. It's a national issue. It's a public health issue. And the more we can refer to this, in my view, all right, as a national problem that needs to be addressed comprehensively, because what you see, frankly, is right now on the regulatory side, despite all this information, this stuff is still not regulated. And what we're hearing, I just heard from EPA during a public conference about 2 weeks ago, I think, or maybe a week ago, Senate hearings. They're suggesting they may now make several more years, because one of the things you have to find in order to regulate these chemicals on a national basis is nationwide occurrence of the chemical. And if it's not found in enough water supplies, it's viewed as a state or local issue. It's going to be left to the states. And my view, and I'll stop, is it is a national issue that needs to be addressed in a national way that it looks at the national health threat. And that's what we really ought to be focusing on. And I think the people in this room really have the power to do that.
Thank you. And I know everybody probably wants to ask some of your own questions. I want to take the opportunity, though, to piggyback on your pet peeves and ask you, the three of you, what journalistic coverage you really want to see that you haven't seen yet? What do you want to see? You know, so you're saying you're frustrated that people are calling these emerging contaminants, for instance. What would you like to see? What stories are we not doing that we should be doing?
Can I jump in on that one real quick?
Yeah.
The one thing I would say is everybody's focused on the fact it's in the water, okay? And to me, nobody's looking at the next step here. What do you do about what's already out there? We put the filters on. That's what absolutely has to happen. All right, this stuff has to be taken out of the water. But what nobody's really focused on yet is then what? What do we do with what's already out there? Because what's in the environment will be there for millions of years unless something is done about what's there and what's already in everyone's blood.
Mm-hmm. So two quick things. One is, as I said, don't wait for government agencies to do testing. I'm a big believer in citizen science, and you can scrape together some money to do some water testing, and your outlets should do that. And then secondly, and I've been wanting to say this for about 35 years, will someone please look at why state health departments don't protect health when it comes to the environment? I mean, you know, I know they have a big mandate, but state health departments almost always minimize exposures and don't take affirmative action to protect health when it comes to pollution issues.
Mm-hmm. Detlef?
I think, you know, educating the public about fluorochemicals is really important, and especially in terms of consumer choices, right? And the main reason why Chemours and other fluorochemical manufacturers make so much money is that they're selling these chemicals and they're being used in all sorts of stuff, you know. So if you buy your couch or your carpet or your microwave popcorn, all of these things could potentially contain fluorochemicals, but most people don't know about it. And I think just making sure that as a public we have a better understanding what our own choices are and how we impact the environment through those choices, I think, would be helpful. And this is hard because understanding supply chains is very, very difficult, you know. So this is not an easy assignment if you really start digging into that.
Judith, I wanted to ask about I've been hearing that maybe EPA talking about designating PFAS hazardous materials. How would that help us? How would that help a community like Hoosick Falls?
It would help get these facilities listed on the federal or state Superfund list. In Hoosick Falls, I felt very strongly that we needed to list this as a federal Superfund site to get the remediation done. You know, putting carbon filters on a drinking water supply doesn't get to the source of the contamination and get it remediated. And at the time, the state didn't want to do it. So we couldn't, you know, EPA has this very elaborate hazard ranking system. You don't just list anything on federal Superfund. You have to have a certain level of contamination, certain number of people affected. In Hoosick Falls, we had other chemicals that allowed us to make the designation, but if it was just PFOA or PFOS, it wouldn't have ranked.
Okay. I'm going to open it up. I want to ask one last question to Rob. Rob, a decision came down earlier this week, right, from in a Pennsylvania case that allowed for medical monitoring, right, in this case about PFAS. Can you tell me a little bit about it and why it is? Do you think it's a big deal, and if so, why?
Yeah, medical monitoring is a legal claim that's existed in a number of states. Some states don't necessarily allow it. Some states allow it, but only if you prove you've also got another claim. The particular case I think you're talking about, Sharon, was a case for a community that brought claims against the U.S. Navy.
Yes.
Outside a military base. And the argument that the government had made was, this is a Superfund cleanup site, and we're already doing our cleanup, and you can't bring a claim against us for medical monitoring because that's going to conflict with our ongoing cleanup decisions. And so it was really kind of a statutory argument about, can somebody bring a private claim to get medical testing against the government, or is that barred by the Superfund statute? And the court said, the lower court had said, no, you can't do that. You can't bring the medical monitoring claim. Just this week, the Third Circuit appellate court said, yes, you can. So I think that that opens the possibility for folks that are outside military bases to potentially try to seek some sort of medical testing from the government. Now, whether you can then still prove you're entitled to the monitoring is a whole another level.
Okay. So when I call and you just say your name and what outlet you represent, and you were first.
Oh.
Okay, and I've been told I should reiterate, and to some, Cheryl is asking, who pays? Okay, anyone?
There, this is a common, who pays, especially if there's spin-off companies, or it's hard if a company's gone bankrupt. If it's bankrupt, you can try to access Superfund funds. Largely, yes, because the Congress has not reimposed the chemical and petroleum fees. There is an important decision in EPA Region 2, and it dealt with this very issue. Kerr-McGee spun off a company so that the successor company didn't have to pay the cost of the cleanup.
Tronox.
Thank you. I was going through my Rolodex of Region 2 Superfund sites. So yeah. The Tronox case is worth looking at, T-R-O-N-O-X. And I think, at least for now, that may address that.
I guess I would just add that, you know, I think that is a critical issue that's being debated right now. We're seeing a lot of communities that are asking the federal government or state government or even the local water suppliers to foot the bill for a lot of this, not only the water treatment systems, but the blood testing or all kinds of costs. And, you know, the question really should be who ought to be paying for that? Should the taxpayers be footing the bill? And, you know, I could tell you a lot of my clients don't think that they should be paying that bill, that it's the folks that put it there that ought to be paying that bill.
Absolutely.
So, unfortunately, the legal remedies are difficult.
Yes.
Karen Schaefer, Freelance Public Radio, Ohio. In the absence of regulation, apart from taking something to court, how do you turn off the tap?
In the absence of regulation, how do you turn off the tap?
How do you get something?
Okay. How do we get companies to stop using and manufacturing these chemicals? Who wants
to
take
that? In the case of Wilmington, North Carolina, it was public outrage and outrage by the local officials. So if within a community everybody pulls together, you can achieve a lot. I'm not sure that it can be replicated all the time. You know, it's difficult in the absence of a legal framework, but public perception does matter, I think.
Yes.
Okay. To your point about reporters testing the water, I was at the summit on this at EPA headquarters, and they at first weren't going to let reporters in, and then they did only for part of the first day.
Right. Where are the problems? I can tell you that the UCMR that folks have been speaking about is a good first stop. It's on the EPA website. And the detection levels, basically, it's going to show you by county all the places where they have found 6 different PFAS that they were testing for. It's already pretty old data. But there are places there that don't know about it. And I can tell you, I was looking at it when it came out, and it was this bizarre situation of going, oh, you can see what's happening across the country, and you simply can't, like, you know, how do you tell these places? And it's been, you know, it's been, it played out differently in every community. But I would start there. Well, I was just going to say, I mean, Peter Gravatt was the one who said it needs to be nationally, right?
Yeah,
but what he's talking, when if you listen to what he said that at the, he's talking about at the 70 part per trillion level. I think the real issue there is what level you're talking about. And so since many other regulators, many scientists feel the level should be lower, then the number of affected communities grows as you lower the level, many, many more places are affected. So,
and states can do their own numbers, as Vermont has, New Jersey, I think Minnesota. And quite honestly, and I think some of us may disagree on this, I don't want this EPA picking the number. It's not going to be based on health protection. So I think you're going to see more states, Governor Cuomo has promised a New York number for about 3 or 4 years. So there's a lot of data for states to pick numbers.
Yes.
My name is Brian. I'm a freelance in New York. I'm just struck in listening to this, the title of the panel is, the fifth-decade DDT. And you can sort of read...
PCBs, I think.
Is
it DDT?
Oh,
okay.
The point applies either way. You reach back through history to the era when we put lead and all kinds of things, and no clue was going on, and then we knew we didn't do anything, and then DDT, and now PFAS, and I just wonder if there are sort of ways to conceptualize this or examples of countries that sort of have inverted the regulatory process such that it's like you don't just manufacture 200,000 things and let them go everywhere before you decide whether it's...
Right. There are 80,000 chemicals used in commerce today, and only a few hundred have really been tested. And you should look at the precautionary principle, and lots written on that.
Yes.
Oh,
well, you were just raising your hand.
I was raising my hand, yeah, but I was going to add to what she said, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you want to ask a question?
Do you want me to? I'll add to what Judith said first. The 80,000 chemicals, I think, I used to use that number all the time. I think in my own reporting, there was a paper that came out from people from EPA and an institute, like a more privately funded institute in Canada, where they looked at all the chemical reporting documents. Rolled it down to probably less than 300, if I recall correctly. And almost all of them, the ones that they should really focus on, that EPA should really focus on, and they're almost all fluorine, they're all halogens, basically. Almost all, so we're talking the flame retardants, the halogenated flame retardants, and also the fluorine-based chemicals. But those are the ones based on persistence, the ability to stay in the body for a long time, either through a long half-life, like Rob mentioned, these chemicals. My question is for Rob. You mentioned the idea of the lawsuits against DuPont that have been litigated after your initial settlement. Have you seen any change in behavior from the company since they thought they teed up a couple of cases in Ohio where those were the ones that they might win and they ended up losing those cases and paid some pretty significant verdicts? Has anything changed? You can make an argument that some things didn't change after your initial victory.
Okay, so has anything changed? I'm going to... Yeah.
Yeah, well, after the initial trial, we went to trial 3 more times, and the next 2 trials also were verdicts against DuPont, and the numbers went up even higher. And those next 2 also had punitive damages against the company, which was a finding of conscious disregard. And we were in the middle of the 4th when they settled all of the 3,500 or so cases. We reached that settlement in spring of 2017. And there's still ongoing medical monitoring in that community. So people are continuing to be diagnosed. And the people who have new diagnoses have a right to bring new claims. And those new claims are being filed.
Garrett Ellis,
yes, sorry.
I was wondering for any of you on the panel what your thoughts are on states passing their own drinking water standards. I know it's it takes forever for EPA to do it. Nobody's really holding their breath that they're actually going to do it on this one, unless maybe Congress makes them. Anyway, so there's a lot of resistance in Michigan from the administration and the legislature to doing that. And I was wondering if you thought there's but there are states like New Jersey and Vermont that have done it, so I want to get your thoughts on whether that's the steps it
yes, I think it's imperative that states pass drinking water standards for these chemicals and that they do it quickly.
I would think there are some states in the U.S. where the expertise on this particular class of chemicals, I think some of the states have some of the best people in the country on this. New Jersey, in particular, is leading the country on really understanding comprehensively not only individual chemicals but the whole class. And, you know, so I think, yeah, some of the states are leading this, much more so than the federal level at this point.
Brady. Yep.
A lot of looking back, but in looking forward, you talk about this as a national problem. I'm wondering what you think, what we're going to see, you know, in a place like Michigan that did start looking for it, dozens of communities are now dealing with this, other places have not yet gotten to that point. What lies ahead for, you know, individual towns, cities, whatever? You know, we've been a lot on the military-based side. What lies ahead?
What lies ahead for cities and towns?
You know, I really think you need to address this in a comprehensive way, dealing with the science in particular. You know, if you look back at the science panel that was set up in West Virginia and Ohio, you know, where you have independent scientists look at this and actually determine in a way, you know, here are the particular health effects that are linked, and most importantly, you know, the parties are bound by it. You know, you can't keep fighting this. My concern is with all the studying going on, you know, you'd have these studies done and then people are still going to fight about it, what the result is. So that's my concern is that we move towards something that gives us a way to address this finally, once and for all, in a class-wide basis. Yes, I think the reason why you're seeing so much, I'm sorry, the question was whether we'll see it other places. I think the reason, for example, we're seeing so much of it in Michigan is because it's being tested for. You know, there's an aggressive testing campaign. New Jersey did it about 10 years ago, looking across the state and found it all across the state, not just one but multiple chemicals. We tested the blood of people in Minnesota and New Jersey 10 years ago. And found multiple PFAS chemicals in blood. This is back 2005, 2006. So I think when the testing happens, it's going to be found. It's just a matter of who does the testing when.
Well, if I could just quickly add, you know, I don't disagree, but also we're not going to find it everywhere. You're going to find it where it was used in manufacturing. You might find it further distances with airborne. But we have enough science now. And if you are running a water utility or a private water company, you are irresponsible if you are not proactively looking for these chemicals. And sometimes the fix is not that hard. It's switching to a different water supply if there's something nearby.
I think we have time for two more in the back. Yes.
Hi, this is John Rumpler, Clean Water Program Director with Environment America. Mm-hmm. Just two quick updates. First,
actually, I have to give it to a reporter first.
I apologize.
Sorry. Okay, Alex. Sorry,
but
Alex.
But we'll stick around.
Yeah, we can. Go ahead, Alex.
Alex Kaufman from both of us. I was wondering, you know, you raised the question of what happens after filtration, and I think an interesting lawsuit that I guess could determine that or maybe not is the lawsuit that the city of Newburgh in New York has filed. And so I wonder, do you see that as the battleground on which that,
do you know about this also?
Yes.
Yeah,
okay.
Responsibility that states or other actors have to do what comes after filtering this out of the water and actually permanently remove it, if possible, from the water source.
Okay, so you're asking what happens after filtration, and does the Newburgh suit tell that story? Or, yeah.
No, I think that just highlights the increasing level of litigation over who's going to pay, you know, and how that gets handled, who should rightfully bear the costs of that? I mean, not only are you talking about the filtration, but you know, what about the spent carbon filters, and what do you do with those, and what do you do with that stuff once it's out there in a landfill? So I think people are just now starting to move toward those issues. You know, right now most of the focus has been on let's get it out of the water, and that's what I think a lot of the litigation's focused on first. But I think that's definitely going to be coming. What do we do with it? What we would do with what's left once it's out of the water?
I think we're out of time, but I'm happy to keep asking. You know, taking questions until we get kicked out. Concern.
Yeah, and the concern is especially through the air emissions, because then you get dry and wet deposition of the PFAS back to the soil, and so then there's also potential for uptake of plants. And then, you know, land application of sewage sludge is another way we put this on the soil, and that's often not discussed.
Yeah, one of the highest levels of drinking water contamination actually was a site in Ohio where the stuff was coming from the air and filtering through the soil over time, not just directly through the river or the groundwater, but actually air deposition through the soil. So that's another thing folks have been focused on, the water, and they need to be looking at where it's going up into the air and then falling.
Okay. One last. Are you a reporter?
Yeah. No, I'm a postdoc from the University of Michigan.
Let me take one more reporter, and then you can come talk to everybody after. Okay, Zoe.
Jump in real quick on the ban part. Just I think that ties into what Luff was talking about, which is it may not legally require something in the U.S., but it could trigger markets and things to change such that even if it's not legally triggering something in the U.S., it could trigger changes in market forces that require the same thing to happen in the United States.
And the Florence question, probably minor. We're looking at that, and we'll see what the data show. But you know, I think you may have mobilized some PFAS that would have flushed down the river, but I don't think there would have been a lot of new deposition on the soil from this event.
Thank you so much for coming, and thanks for coming.